Time to take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, works out of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab and comes by about once a month to talk with us about what's going on in the world of insects and certainly to answer your questions as well. And I hope you'll join in. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. And Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
Bed bugs are still in the news.
Oh, boy. I had two samples in today already. So,
What's this icy carbon dioxide business as a way of getting rid of bed bugs?
Well, I mean, what we've been forced to because of the resistance to the standard treatments of insecticides is to look at physical means. And, you know, either you can heat an insect up or freeze it, one of the two. And so the direction has been looking at various steam machines, giant ovens where you're putting. I mean, can you imagine the problem if you've got a bed bug infestation in a big screen TV? I mean, there's no way you could treat it even if they weren't. But in this case, they'll put it up and heat it. Well, on the other side, the cold. And so they're using dry ice and those kind of things. Plus, high levels of carbon dioxide can work as a fumigant. So people are just looking for something that works. And as I said, it's been going more the direction of these physical means of freezing or heating because they can't become resistant to that. So,
all right. Well, Bob in Woodruff has a question for you. So let's go to Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
Well, I've been waiting for a year for an answer on this one. Last spring when I was cleaning my downspouts and they had a lot of year-old debris that was partly decayed, about 15 or 20 beetles came out of there, and they were about the shape of a watermelon seed, and I think they were probably 3/4 of an inch long and 3/4 of an inch wide and 1 1/4 inch long, and probably 3/8, 1/2 inch thick. They were really big, and they were really pretty looking animals. It looked like black, and they had cream or white colored stripes running the long ends. I don't remember if they had pinchers, but if they did, I know they never used them in a defensive manner. I have no idea what they were, and I'm just curious to hear what I saw.
Okay, well, I'm taking a bit of a stab. The problem is because just the sheer numbers of beetle species, with that kind of environment, with things decaying, there's a family of beetles called the pleasing fungus beetles, and there are some pretty interesting ones. You know, at first, before you talked about the white markings, you know, it could have been a ground beetle, it could have been some of the scarab beetles that are associated with decaying vegetable matter, but those tend to either be pure metallic or dark black. But with that white flecking in there, I wonder if it may have been a species of pleasing fungus beetle, but even that is a bit of a guess on my part. But there are some relatively large size ones, and so that would be my first guess.
All right. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Judy and Custer, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hello, Larry and Phil. I'm calling about an old sighting also. Early in October, I was sitting at our house. It was very hot, and a bug fell down on my back, and I immediately brushed it off onto the floor, and lo and behold, it was a big black spider. It was about 1 1/4 inch long and 3/4 of an inch wide. It was the blackest, most beautiful spider I'd ever seen. And on its abdomen, it had red markings like a figure eight. Well, it was stunned on the floor. And then when I thought, oh, wait a minute, figure eight, that's the same as an hourglass. I immediately thought, okay, black widow spider. Now, unfortunately, at that point, I was sort of stunned, and I squashed it, and I feel very bad about that. But I have these questions. First of all, could it have come from outside? Because I had thought they were more a southern spider. But the website I looked at said that they could be outside all the way up in Wisconsin. Or might it have come from some new couches we had just had delivered a couple of days before? The second question I have, is it possible that she could have laid eggs, because it was in the fall, and that's the time for spiders to lay eggs?
Mm-hmm.
And if so, where would I look for the egg sacs?
Okay. Well, we do have northern widows up here, and they're not real common. And the spider itself is a very secretive spider, likes to live in attics and just out-of-the-way places. You can find them in wood piles sometimes, but they're really quite infrequent. My other thought when you were describing it is that some of the jumping spiders would fit that description. The main difference is that the black widow is very shiny and smooth skinned, whereas the jumping spiders are velvety. And, you know, and when I think of them, they almost think of these black velvet pictures where you paint, you know, with bright colors on, because they usually have. And yeah. Now the
this
jumping
was more velvety. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then I think you got a jumping spider. And they don't make a nest. They go out and hunt their prey down. And so that wouldn't be unusual to have one fall from the ceiling, because they're just out cruising looking for something to feed on. And nothing to worry about there. Black widows, again, I would not think, even if one did come with the furniture. And I do see that. In fact, I just had a sample come in last week of somebody had sent somebody a pine cone from out east. And lo and behold, hiding in the pine cone was about half-grown female black widow, which, of course, caught the person's attention. So we do see that. But again, I think the average living environment that we have is not suitable. So even if there were eggs laid, the little spiders would die in very short order, and I really wouldn't be concerned about that.
Mm-hmm. So those jumping spiders have this red, mottled red and yellow hourglass on it?
Or even white. Phidippus, which is a very common genus, is quite variable in its color scheme. And so it does have this orangish red marking or white markings, in usually on the dorsal surface. And again, they're very attractive spiders and as a group, and they vary quite a bit in size. I've seen some Phidippus that, were even a little bit bigger than you describe. Most of them are about half that size, but you do see some rather large ones.
And what was the name of the spider again?
Well, if you do a search on jumping spiders on the internet, that's a family we call Salticids, and there's a big group of it. And the genus Phidippus is those little black ones that we see quite commonly.
Okay, and they are not venomous.
No more than regular spiders. I mean, the ones that get the press are black widow because of the neurotoxins involved in their saliva, and also the brown recluse that causes the ulceration, but that's not a native spider to Wisconsin. So most other spiders, on the rare occasion they bite, can cause some localized tissue activity, but nothing worse than that.
Oh, well, good. I didn't kill a black widow.
No. All right.
Okay.
Thanks,
Thank
Judy.
You.
Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. Bob in Darlington is up next. Bob, hi.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Phil. This is Bob Aylesworth from the pharmacy school.
Mm-hmm.
Remember here 20 years ago I gave you the black widow spider?
Yes.
Wasn't that wonderful?
Yes, and I said it's interesting. I'm in the process of starting to write a book about all the interesting things that come in, and there's definitely a chapter on black widows. So.
Yeah, that people give to you, too.
Yes.
I've got an important question, though. I've got by my deck. I have a beautiful deck here in Darlington. And I have an ash tree on either side of it. I wonder what's going on with the emerald ash bark borer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're still at a point that there have been no positive intercepts in the state.
Yeah, I've heard that too the last few weeks.
And which is very encouraging. You know, the infestation down in Illinois, or they have more than one, we're learning. Unfortunately, that when we do find these infestations, it's very hard to delineate exactly where they stop and start, which is influencing, I think, on a state policy basis. And I think, now each case is going to be looked at. But the old scenario of automatically cutting every ash tree within a half a mile, I don't think is on the table anymore, because it's
all good.
You know, it's not a realistic way of looking at this, again, when you can't draw the line. The other thing that we do, tell people, again, that have very nice trees in their landscape is that, there are ways of protecting those trees once we get into the problem. We're not promoting treating the trees yet, but, if it does get to be a case, you will be able to salvage, these property or trees in the home lawn. The ones that aren't going to be worth treating are the ones out in the woods, basically, because of the cost of treatment.
Oh, I didn't hear that. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. And so... So, for that reason, one of my favorite trees is the white ash that's called Autumn Purple.
Uh-huh.
I tell people...
I don't have those. I have kind of it's got green, what do you call the leaves? They kind of gather together. The leaves are... I don't know exactly what to call that, but they're not like other trees, the way their leaves are presented.
Yeah, well, they have that compound leaf where you've got
that's
that, right?
It. That's it. Yeah.
And but as I said, so for high value landscape trees, there will be ways of they'll just become high maintenance, and I think that's something people have to realize. But as I said, I really am encouraged. I don't think it's a question. I think biologically, we all know it's inevitable; it will happen. But I'm really encouraged how slow this is transpiring so far, and that may just be what we face is a way of managing it in a way that it will move slowly rather than like a wildfire through the state.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Bob, for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, we have lots of callers. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call, or in Madison, 263-1890. Debbie in Madison is next. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I have a question. This has to do with bed bugs. I have a friend who was in an apartment that had bed bugs and was bitten sometimes and has now moved out of the apartment and is looking for a temporary place to stay. And I don't mind offering a temporary place to stay for a human, but I don't want to do it for the bed bugs.
Right.
And so I'm just wondering, how do I know when somebody's bed bug free? So is it like...
it's not the person, it's their articles that are the ones that bring the infestation in, because bed bugs don't live on a person. And so clothing is not a big problem, although in very heavy infestations, I have seen them there. But what you worry about more is furniture. Definitely mattresses would be a real, real concern because it's so difficult to get those cleaned up.
Okay.
But nightside stands, even clocks and stuff, I get... Because bed bugs like to hide in cracks and crevices most of the time. And so we find them in lots of places. And although 70 to 80% of the population will be on the bed frame and the mattress itself, I've seen them in all kinds of things, hanging pictures and those kind of things. And so that's where, I think we'd have to be careful on any kind of articles of, that especially would found in the bedroom or, a stuffed chair, a sofa, those kind of things are really the most problematic.
So if somebody were just to bring clothes and toilet articles and...
Yeah, there shouldn't be a problem.
Then I'm okay.
Right.
Yep.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks, Deb. And on to Mike in Delavan. Hi, Mike.
Hi. My sister lives on a farmhouse, and she's got a huge population of... I don't know if they're Chinese beetles or ladybugs. I guess ladybugs is what I consider them to be. And I'm wondering, what is attracting them? What are they eating? And is there anything that you can do to discourage them?
Yeah, and basically what they're about is they like to spend the winter rent-free in sheltered locations. And the more exposed a building is, the more attractive it is. And then, of course, an older farmhouse has so many little nooks and crannies. And so all of her headaches came in during last October. And then they don't eat, they don't breed, they just basically live in the wall voids. And then when you get warm days, if you wake up and you basically have problems all winter long until maybe the next couple of weeks, it should warm up enough that they should leave. But it will happen again next fall. And so the two things we suggest is one, if possible, to seal things up. But in an old farmhouse, that may not be reasonable. So then the second choice is there are sprays that would be applied to the outside of the building around the end of September or early October to kill them and repel them. The sprays do both before they get in. And this time window. Spraying in the middle of July is worthless. Spraying once they get in is worthless. But knowing that the key will be when we start to get the first couple frosts and then those nice Indian summer days is when they are attracted. And they're attracted visually. So I bet you it's the south side of the structure where most of them are coming in.
Mm-hmm. Where would I get that spray at? Or where would she get that spray at?
Well, you can either have it commercially applied. What they're using, though, are basically the same things that we're using in dairy barns for fly control, things like permethrin, cyfluthrin, bifenthrin. There's a number of these pyrethroid insecticides that are there. What it takes, though, is upwards of a couple gallons of dilute spray. I mean, you've got to spray all the overhangs, all the not the windows themselves, but around the frames, the siding, to give enough protection. And so it's a question. You often have to get up on a ladder, and it's not something you can do with one of these aerosol cans. You need a bigger sprayer than that.
Mm-hmm.
Good. All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer on this, the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, Larry Mueller here. And Phil, I know you wanted to say a word or two about Janice Stiefel, who is someone who...
Yes, a couple weeks ago we lost a very special person to those of us in Wisconsin that like insects. Janice was the newsletter editor for the Wisconsin Entomological Society. Lived up in Sister Bay, up in Door County, although I think originally she was from the Plymouth area. And I had known Janice for years. She was an incredible photographer, an incredible naturalist. She used to love to collect caterpillars, take pictures of them, and then the difficulty is to correlate what they will grow up to be. So Janice would rear these things out, and to be honest, added an awful lot to our understanding of some of these noctuid moths and the like. And was sorry to hear that Janice had passed on. And again, anybody who had any experience with her enthusiasm about the insect world and just the natural world in general, I know she did a lot of talks and walks up in the Door County area, the Ridges area. So I think a lot of people probably were blessed to have contact with her.
And she will be missed. And appreciate that comment about Janice. And we have some more callers online, so we'll go back to the phones and take some calls. Robin in Racine, I believe, is on next. Robin, hello.
Good morning, and good morning, Phil.
Morning.
Hi there. I work at a private estate in Heartland in Chinookwa, right on North Lake. And last summer, for the first time in my life, and I've lived in Wisconsin my entire life, I ran across what was a similar to the size of a mosquito, had six legs, transparent wings, and the legs came out and down, and when it walked, it was within a robotic movement. And I've searched the internet, I've searched all of my insect books, and I have not identified it yet.
But was it the size of a mosquito or much bigger?
Just a hair bigger.
Well, you know, my first take on it was it may be a type of crane fly, and although most crane flies are quite a bit larger, mm-hmm. There are small species. It's a very large group, and they... Again, are basically almost a mosquito without the biting mouth parts is the first thing you pick up. They also lack little scales on their wings like mosquitoes do, but that's something you need to look under a microscope. And so they said, do a search on crane flies. Most of them are these what people would say are, you know, four or five times the size of a normal mosquito. And the name comes from the fact that the legs are really long and gangly like a crane. And when they walk, you would see that. In fact, there's even one subfamily of that called the phantom crane flies that I'm a little suspicious it might be, but that's the direction I would look.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you so much for your time.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Thomas in Manitowoc, you are next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I was wondering, Phil, if you could tell me about the peach borer. Will those go into apricot and plum trees also? And is there a effective organic control for those once they're in your trees?
Well, the peach tree borer is a species that's more common south of us, and their claim to fame is attacking the trunks of trees in the genus Prunus. And so you will see them, you know, I see them on cherries more than anything else. And the moths lay their eggs in June, and then the eggs hatch, and the caterpillars burrow into the trunk and cause a lot of weeping and bleeding. There's also some bacterial problems on Prunus that look similar, and so sometimes people confuse it. And really the story is once the critters get in there, even if you're inclined to use standard chemicals, it won't work because they're protected underneath the bark of the tree. And so it's a one generation a year. In some cases, wrapping will help, at least because they won't lay their eggs. The other thing I will tell you that the less injuries there are on the trunk, the better, because they do seem to be attracted to those areas. Now, organically, boy, the problem with the organic insecticides is they break down so quickly. And really what you need here is something that would probably last for 2 to 3 weeks, because that's kind of the egg-laying period in June. Now, an old way of treating these was with mothballs, which isn't really organic. It's just kind of a home remedy, where they would use it almost as a fumigant. Yeah, I'm not real keen on that. I said that was kind of a 1920s treatment. Another one that people have tried with some success is to take a paper clip or wire, and when you see one of these oozing holes, is to poke up in there with the idea that you're physically going to cause injury to the larvae and it won't develop. But again, I don't know of any organic spray per se that could be used that would be very effective.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Tom. Dick in Reedsburg, your turn. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I make maple syrup. And usually in the spring we have moths in the buckets.
Mm-hmm.
And this year I haven't seen maybe one or two moths, and we usually have lots of them. And instead, there's little tiny, well, they're the size of a mosquito, and they look just like a mosquito, and they've been more in the buckets this year. And I was wondering what kind of moths they are first, and then what you think about the mosquitoes.
Well, you know, we have a number of different, when people have sent me the moths, I've seen more than one different species. Again, one of the biggest moth family we have here is the cutworm family we call noctuids, and these are some noctuids, and we have some that overwinter as adults, so they're there right away to wake up in the spring. I wonder, one of the reasons, you know, with as much snow that's sitting on a lot of the ground for so long, I don't think the insects have woken up yet, and so I think that may play a little part in here. And then I'm really not sure. There's so many different families of flies that utilize sugar water for a source. I'm not sure which one of those, but again, you can always send them in. I'd be happy to take a peek at it. But the moths, they don't have a common name, you know. The other thing that I've seen is some of the little geometrid or inchworm moths, too, at times, that are active right away in the spring. You know, one of the ways that we collect moths is called sugaring, and basically you take a little bit of beer, some syrup, some sugar, and they basically paint it on the trunk of trees, and then you come at night with a light, and so many moths are attracted, and the more that this ferments, the better it is.
Yeah,
because they come in and feed on that, and then you can get them. In fact, to be honest, especially if you use some beer in there, sometimes the moths get intoxicated, and so they're relatively easy to collect when they're drunk. That's the best way to put it. But.
Now, I also had a centipede in one bucket and a harvest man spider.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, would they be after the sugar, or would they be after the little bugs trying to get a?
Well, you know, I wonder if they just fell in. One of the ways that we collect insects that are active at night on the ground is with what we call a pitfall trap, which is just basically a small container put flush in as these insects and harvestmen and whatnot are walking. They just fall in and can't get out. And so I wonder if they were just going through a normal search for something and just happened to fall in the buckets by accident.
Okay.
How's the maple syrup going this year?
Great year. It's been just about perfect.
Wonderful. Thanks, Dick. Thanks a lot for calling. I've heard that this was a great year.
Yeah, I had a feeling the way things were temperature-wise fluctuating, it probably would be a good year.
Thanks again, Dick. And let's go to Boyceville. Talk to Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Larry. How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you and Professor Pelletieri for both being treasures, Wisconsin treasures.
Well, thank you.
I really mean that. Got a question about a bug that infects maples. I know there was an outbreak out on the East Coast, and then around the Chicagoland area, there was an outbreak around that. Has there been any new information? Has that spread? Do you know about this?
Yes. The critter was an Asian longhorn beetle.
Oh, okay.
And there was an infestation in Chicago, and there has been one ongoing in New Jersey and New York. The good news on the Chicago one is there has been no beetles collected for at least 2 or 3 years. The feeling was they originally came in on pallet wood from China and escaped, and they were very aggressive down in the Chicago area and caught it early enough and removed every infested tree within a matter of hours if they could get to it, and that eliminated the infestation. It has not worked as well in New Jersey, and part of it is more of a political reason in that they don't have the laws on the books that allow them to be as aggressive. And so the trees are standing for a number of weeks before they're cut, which allows the beetles to spread. And so they're still putting up the fight there. But until they get those laws changed, I think it's going to be far more difficult. And, you know, they always said Chicago is a city that works. And boy, as I said, that was a classic example in that they just didn't mess around. Now, unfortunately, the people that had these beautiful maple trees on your front yard, they would just come in and cut them down. By putting up that kind of sacrifice, it did eliminate the problem. That really was the premise of why people thought maybe this would work for this emerald ash borer. The trouble there is that the infestation in Michigan was so large, was there for 10 to 12 years before they caught it. The insect can apparently fly a little better. And really the biggest concern, and you probably heard us talk about this before, is infested firewood. It's a small insect. It's overlooked. This Asian longhorn beetle that was down in Chicago is so big, you wouldn't miss it in the wood. I mean, it's kicking out all kinds of sawdust, making all kinds of noise. And so it didn't get transported as much, whereas we're finding even some of these infestations in Illinois that we've talked about that are so close to the Wisconsin border, they've traced a couple of these back to people who had summer homes in Michigan and brought infested firewood, and that's how the critters got to Illinois.
Hmm. I kind of wondered with out here in western Wisconsin, there's a really big, the place where you save big money, distribution center.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a lot of different pallets coming in from all over the place, especially China.
Well, things have changed because of some of these problems. Is there are fumigation rules now about pallets leaving that they've had to be treated in a way that it would kill any insects that are there. In fact, one of the things that when I see once in a while something that's gotten through, the first thing I do is get a hold of the USDA people so that they can trace this back to see where the breakdown is in the procedure. So, you know, unfortunately, we didn't learn this lesson early enough, and we've got a number of insect problems that have gotten here through infested pallet wood and similar things. But as I said, now there really has been a tightening up of international shipping of just that kind of thing because of these kind of headaches.
Well, I'm really glad we're not going to lose the maples like we did the elms and everything.
Yeah, well,
yes.
Let's hope that there nothing else comes to do that.
Oh, I hope so too, Larry. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Let's go to Tracy in Arena. Hi, Tracy.
How you doing, folks?
Good.
I've got a question. I live in a sandy-soiled area right along the Wisconsin River Valley there, and I've noticed with cherry trees, plums, apple trees, maybe some more non-fruit-bearing trees as well, that I'm having neon green-like aphids and or candescent-like in color beetle infestation that literally eats holes right through the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And two questions, being in the soil surface that I'm in, what effects is that having on my trees, and what means of discouragement to prevent their presence might you have in mind?
Okay. Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's a non-native insect. In fact, my colleague Ken Rafa has had students working on that in about three or four other species of invasive weevils. I know it as the imported green weevil, and it refers to that incredible coloration you get. If you get one under the microscope, they're really quite attractive. But they are a root-feeding insect, and then the adults feed on a variety of things, although that we seem to find birch, poplar, and raspberry on the top of the list. But I have seen them feed on other things, too. And we have not been able to document a lot of plant damage, although the back question is there something subtle going on there? And that's what Ken has been looking at. And that has more to do with the grubs feeding. The adults, I would tell you, the feeding is cosmetic. I mean, it really is not causing a problem as far as the health of the tree. They're just not eating enough foliage. Now, if you had a tree in front of your picture window and they were, you know, thinning the leaves and you didn't want that, you could treat the tree, and probably the most convenient way to treat a larger tree is with some of these systemic insecticides. You know, Bayer makes their tree and shrub insecticide, which is taken up by the roots. And if you treated that tree in the spring, it would last the whole season and stop the insects from feeding on it. If they fed on it, they would die. And so, but I would only encourage that, again, for cosmetic reasons, for very, you know, valuable trees that you just want to stay lush and heavy. And I would say don't worry about what's going on with the other stuff, because it really is not causing any kind of significant problems to the tree.
You mentioned grubs, and we have a very large problem with ground moles and knowing that they feed on grubs and such. So that could have something to do with it, too, I would imagine.
Well, the grub of the weevil, though, is quite a bit smaller. I mean, it really is kind of innocent. And the other thing about moles that we always tell people, you know, sometimes people, I think, try to simplify stories. And you know, so I've had a lot of people that have put insecticide on their lawns to kill the grubs so the moles stop coming in. But it turns out that the moles also feed on earthworms and the like. And so it's not as simple as just saying, well, if there's no grubs, you don't have moles. But the moles do indicate that there's got to be something going. And, of course, you know, sandy soils aren't the best for earthworms, so it may just be that grubs are the main thing going on there.
Sure. Well, I appreciate the information. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Tracy, for calling. And John in Germantown, you are next. Hi, John.
Hello, Larry. Hi, Phil. I I'm actually not in Germantown. I'm on my way up to Wausau, but I can hear the drum beat and the roars of the drums right now as the earwigs come marching on in the spring. and I'm wondering if you could give us all some tips as to prevent them getting into your home, so on and so forth.
How do we prevent those earwigs?
You know, my ultimate answer for people is if you make your backyard a sandbox, you won't have any. Because what goes on, they're really quite interesting. The earwigs overwinter as adults. In fact, I saw one about 3 weeks ago in my basement, which just kind of floored me, because they usually don't wake up or come out of the ground until the end of May. And at that time, the female has already hatched her eggs, and the immature earwigs are half grown. And what's weird about it is that earwig females take care of the eggs. I mean, there's some maternal care there, which is not very common in insects. So then about the last week of May, first week of June, they come out half grown, and they are most active at night. They like places that are lush and damp and full of foliage. So, you know, hostas next to your foundation is earwig heaven. And so one of the things, by just keeping plant material and things drier along the foundation, will help a lot. To be honest, coming indoors is purely accidental on their purposes, because there's nothing to eat indoors. It's not a good environment. But we look at the weaknesses, and I think the weakness of most homes is where the foundation meets the siding. To have that sealed or caulked will keep ants and all kinds of critters out. And even though houses can be energy efficient, you can see how an insect can squeeze and weasel its way through. So the combination of keeping vegetation to a minimum if possible, secondly, sealing things up, and then if that it just doesn't work, then there are treatments that you can use. And I think the biggest problem I see people is they'll put a little bit of insecticide on their daisy because the earwigs are feeding on the flowers. But when we treat them, we tend to treat the mulch, and we soak the mulch, and almost any garden insecticide will work, because that's where the earwigs are hiding during the day. And by treating those hiding places, you get the best success. So these barrier treatments along the foundation and the flower beds would be the most effective.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, John, for calling. And Chris in Kewaunee, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Phil and Larry. This my question is about determining whether an infestation of powder post beetles is active or inactive. I've looked at the dust that's kind of under the holes, and I can't really tell if it's new or if it's old. And I'm wondering if maybe a pheromone trap might help me discover if there are adults active in the area.
There would be, but I'm not aware of the pheromone trap being available. I guess what I tell people is, you know, the sawdust color tends to go more of a dark yellowish orange when it's old. You know, if you go up to a infested log and tap it with a hammer, I expect sawdust to come out. So that doesn't help. But I would tell you what I think would determine it is if you clean stuff off and you've got something that's not experiencing those kind of vibrations, you will know they're there in June and July, because the sawdust will be getting pushed out in front of your eyes. I mean, they're active at that time. And so aside from the sawdust being more a light yellow to white color, you can see it accumulate when things finally warm up enough to wake up the insects. And if you don't see that, then I don't think they're active at all.
Okay, that's great. That was my next question. When would we actually see them emerging from the wood so that we could actually see it?
Yeah, most of although they can string out a bit, most of their activity is relatively early. So May and early June is when I see the adults. The other thing you may experience, I mean, the adult powder post beetle looks a lot like the red flower beetles you get in cereal and flour, just a little bit bigger and a little bit darker, and they will be attracted to your windows. So another way of seeing what's going on is, you know, they sell these little sticky traps, or what we call glue boards, and you can put those on your windowsills, and if they're powder post beetles, you know, flying there trying to get out, they will be captured in there, and that would be another indicator. It's kind of passive compared to a pheromone trap, but I think would be very effective.
Mm-hmm.
Great. In 3 years, I've never seen one, so would that be an indication that they aren't there? Or...
Yes, okay. Pretty much. And, you know, the problem, too, is... they tend to do better on newer wood because it's higher in moisture and higher in starch content. And as wood starts to age, it becomes less suitable. Although these things are amazing. In normal circumstances, they go through a generation once a year in Wisconsin. Down south, they can go through two or three generations. I had a gentleman sent me a powder post beetle that emerged from the neck of a guitar that he had made 3 years before that. Now, what was interesting is, you know, the moisture content of this guitar wood was down to 8%, which is the limits of the beetle. But that's also explained why it was so long for it to come out. It was probably pretty highly stressed. Now, the good thing is, I'm sure they weren't going to reinfest it and whatnot. This was a beetle that was in that wood before it was even made into a guitar neck. And so you do see some of these oddballs, but those are the ones we really don't have to worry about. And again, anything that's painted, sealed, if the beetles aren't there yet, they can't get into it because they need open vessels of the wood to lay their eggs. So we see problems in barn board and that rough cut lumber generally, but not stuff that's sealed up.
And if these are over 100-year-old beams that I have, is it probably also less possible for them to be working in that old wood?
Yeah, and less suitable. And the other thing is that if it's especially this is a residence that's heated in the winter, that really is very tough on them. You see them out in barns doing well because, again, the humidities are higher and they don't get the moisture drawn out of them like we do when we take wood indoors, whether you use a wood burner or, you know, just standard heating. That dries the wood out, and that's another reason that powder post beetles are less successful. And usually the only time I see them successful in normal year-round residence is if there's some other source of moisture keeping the moisture level up.
All right.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling, Chris. Appreciate it. And Richard in La Crosse, your turn now. Hi, Richard.
Good morning, Phil, Larry.
Hi.
I got a little problem. I hope I don't have a problem with them. Carpenter ants.
Okay.
About 6 weeks ago, it was the first time I've ever seen them. I built the house about 23 years ago, and just like 6 weeks ago was the first time I've ever seen one in the house, and I've seen both sizes, the small and the large, and I saw one with wings, and I put out some of the taro bait things, and now they're completely gone. I'm wondering if they're just hiding or...
Yeah, well, you know, it does sound like there's a colony in the house. I mean, the only other way I could explain it is if you had brought in some firewood that had some ants in it and they kind of woke up from there. The other thing about it is, I mean, the colonies are so slow to grow that the first couple of years, you don't expect to see a lot of ants, but the presence of a wing form tells me the colony is at least 3 years old because the colonies don't produce wing forms till then. Taro does work, but it only works about 20% of the time. And it has to do with the ants and their feeding preferences. If the ants hit the bait and are very active and then they disappear, that's a very good sign. If the ants show no interest in the bait, then my question is, I don't think enough boric acid got picked up to take back to the colony to feed through. So it may still take some time. I'm encouraged that normally now, as the warmer it gets, the more activity you should see for about the next 2 or 3 weeks. Once food becomes available outside, it's not unusual to see the ants disappear just because they're out looking for food outside. It would not hurt to put some honey on a piece of wax paper and put it in a couple rooms and just leave it there. What you're trying to do is draw the ants out, make them show their presence, and you'll see more activity at night than during the day. Mm-hmm. So that might be something you might consider. But you may have solved it with a taro. What's tough to answer is what was going on at 2 o'clock in the morning when you were sleeping. Were they hitting the bait? You know, and that's when they would have hit the bait. So there may have been more positive effect to it than you saw.
All right.
The only time that I ever see them is on the carpeted basement floor, and you're right, they are active at night because in the mornings when I'll see them down there. But they're almost like you'd think they were dead until you go over and try to pick them up, and you can see they're alive yet.
Well, you know, depending on the temperature, if the basement temperature is above 54, 55 degrees, they should be able to move pretty readily. And if not, they may be just highly stressed. The other thing about them is that, you know, although we normally talk about them in wet, rotten wood, I've seen them in hollow core doors. And the other place that they seem to be quite common to see some activity is in the sill plates that we, you know, put insulation in for energy efficiency creates this little pocket. And I've been amazed the number of times I've seen colonies move into that little environment. You know, apparently it must keep the humidity up. They like to be there. But that also proves the point that we always tell people is they don't eat wood. They live in environments that tend to be soft. So that's why they get in styrofoam insulation, in rotting compromised wood. But if the cavity already exists, sometimes they'll move into that. And so... being like, you know, I would keep up. If you started to still see activity, it might be worth pulling some of those fiberglass bats and just take a peek to see if the ants indeed are not nesting in one of those little pockets.
Okay.
All right.
Good. Thanks for the info.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW entomologist, our guest today with UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist Larry Mueller here. Just wanted to mention before we go on that Steve Paulson and I will be talking at something called Wednesday Night at the Lab here on the UW-Madison campus. That's tomorrow night starting at 7 o'clock in room 1111, the auditorium. It's of the Genetics Biotechnology Center. It's right at the intersection of University Avenue and Randall Avenue in Madison. It's right on the bus line there. Free admission, and it should be a lot of fun. We'll be on from 7 to about 8:15 or 8:30 or so talking about our experiences in radio with talking science. So that's going to be a lot of fun, and you're invited. It's free, and hope you can make it tomorrow night. And again, it's at the Genetics Biotechnology Center on the UW-Madison campus. Should be a lot of fun. Back to insects here, and Jerry in River Falls is up next. Hi, Jerry.
Hello. Hi. Hi. I was, if you know something about the earthworms, their life cycle and what they do in the wintertime. And how they reproduce, or
little out of I can give you what I know. It's you know, being an entomologist, if it doesn't have six legs, we don't talk about it. But I mean, there are a number of species of earthworms, and if you probably heard on shows that have been done here before, earthworms are not necessarily native to our woodlands and whatnot in Wisconsin. Yeah. And all earthworms have both sexes, but yet they still cross fertilize. They lay a little, basically almost a purse-like egg sac that they utilize. Depending on the species, they overwinter either as eggs or they just crawl deep enough to stay in the ground and stay rather inactive, just like insects. You know, being cold-blooded, they can kind of turn their bodies on again, off again, and then in the spring come. And most of the earthworms, that is their mating season. That's their high peak of activity, I'm guessing right now, from what I'm aware of it, there is at least 36 different species of earthworms you can run into. And again, most of them are non-native to our area, although there are earthworms down in the southeast United States that didn't experience the ice age per se that did survive. I mean, that was the problem, is that the conditions were so hostile during the ice age, there's no way worms could survive up in this area.
Hmm. Interesting.
Okay.
Thanks, Jerry. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Dave in La Crosse is next, so let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Say, Phil, I'm wondering about Ochlea rotatus chapaticus in Dane County, where you found it or where it was found, and what is your thought about it being established there?
Okay, again, I for some reason I'm drawing a blank on the Ochlea rotatus. What's the common name?
Ochlea rotatus chapaticus. It's the imported invasive species that was brought to the eastern part of the United States, mosquito species. And
Okay. Yeah, thanks. That's where I was just going. My colleague, Susan Paskowitz, has been doing quite a bit of mosquito work, both biting counts and evaluating traps and all kinds of things. And they did pick up the Japanese pool breeding mosquito that is this Ochlea rotatus japonicus. It's I'm an old guy, so everything was 80s back when I was in school. So it was a different genus. But and from what we heard, you know, that was that species had been picked up 3 or 4 times up with a group up in Camp McCoy that's been doing some mosquito evaluation. And then when you saw other states around us, we weren't the only ones to pick it up this past year. Now, the concern has always been this is a container breeding mosquito that seems to be more efficient at transmitting diseases. And the containers are the kind of things that would be around people's houses. And so it's a lot like Culex, which is the genus we've always worried about with West Nile. But I will tell you that the mosquito numbers have still been extremely low. And so with counts now of at least 3 years for sure that has been caught in the state, it's just been one here, one there at best. Now, what we've always been concerned about is this mosquito in the East Coast has done a little bit better. That's where it first started, is in the New York area. We were surprised it got here this quickly. It kind of took a big jump from parts of Ohio to here. But so far, other than, you know, it's kind of something that's of some concern, but we haven't seen it evolve to that point yet. So other than that one specimen that was caught in the Madison area, I don't know of any other specimens that were caught in Wisconsin this past year, but I did see reports out of Minnesota in particular that they had also picked it up.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Jean in Ashland, on to you. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I was wondering if you have any measurement numbers that would pertain to food-safe screens and meshes, like if you want to screen out the little tiny fruit flies, or if you want to screen out bugs from your maple syrup pails, or you want to screen out bugs from if you're making a solar food hydrator, how tiny do you have to get, and where would you get this? Food-safe items, not fiberglass or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in greenhouses and when we make insect cages, we use a type of screen called Lumite, but I'll be honest with you, the mesh is much smaller than you need because we're worrying about thrips and other things that are not going to be, you know, other than running a greenhouse, things that you would worry about. I don't know really what the mesh size off the top of my head would be. I mean, the size of a fruit fly is about definitely anything under a half a millimeter in size would be sufficient. I had just gotten an advertisement, this little piece of screen in the mail last week, but I didn't pay enough attention with it other than putting it on my bulletin board. I guess the best thing is if you could just email me, I'd be happy to just look a couple things up and give you both the size, but also, again, some of the food safe. And I'm not sure if this one that was sent to us was or wasn't.
The other thing is, should one go maybe to filters, like the filter, the nylon filters of fabric made for apple cider presses?
I don't know if you have to go that fine a mesh, is my guess.
Uh-huh.
Definitely, again, if your concern is just fruit flies and things like that.
But those little tiny thing. Fruit flies, when they're tiny, they walk right through any kind of screening. And then there's the little stick, little black stick. they look like little straight sticks, and they can walk through.
Little springtails?
Springtails
would be something, it would be a contaminant sometimes, especially outdoors, because they're a very common soil creature. But still, you know, insects, although they get small, I mean, the distinction to me is between insects and mites. I mean, mites tend to get small enough that that's when we have to go to some great extremes and almost go to filters. But as long as mites are not a concern there, as I said, I think you can get some fine enough mesh screening that would be more than sufficient. But as I said, if you email me, my email direct is Pelletieri. Well, it's a short version of my last name. It's Pelletti, P-E-L-L-I-T-T-E, at entomology, E-N-T, OMOLOGY dot WISC dot EDU.
And you have suppliers that
I will be able to get some, as I said, in particular, I want to look more closely at that advertisement I had gotten last week of the insect mesh screen that was given.
Good luck. Thank you very much, Gene, for calling. And Elliot in Platteville, we're on to you. Hi, Elliot.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
I work out at Pioneer Farm out here in Platteville, and we're doing some insect sweep net samples. And I found a true bug that I kind of don't really know what it is, and I was wondering if you guys could help me out a little bit on that.
Sure. Probably the best thing is if you can just get a picture of it or send me the specimen, one of the two, I'd be happy to.
Okay. I was just wondering quick if you knew if there's, because it doesn't have those enlarged femora like ambush bugs do or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there's any other dorsally flattened true bugs around in Wisconsin that I could try and look up families.
You know, a group that is incredibly diverse is the assassin bugs, the red duviids. You know, although they have kind of a standard one, there are some long, skinny ones that almost look like walking sticks. And as I said, that's a group that always surprises me how diverse it is. And so that would be one of the first ones. Nabid bugs tend to be a little bit fatter and skinny, so they don't quite fit the flattened part of it. And there are a couple other families that are not necessarily predaceous that you could run into. But as I said, I think if you get a halfway decent digital image, I should be able to do something with it.
Okay, yeah, I should be able to do that.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Barry in Madison, your turn. Hi, Barry.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
We moved into a new home last fall, and I'm pretty confident that the foundation is pretty tight, but we have a live-in basement. It was designed as a bedroom sort of situation. And we a big 2-inch long, half-inch wide bug showed up last night and scared the bejeebies out of my daughter. And you know, all I can think is we have two large drains in the basement, in the laundry room and the shower, that have kind of open grids on them. And I've noted that the previous owner had Roto-Rooter down in those drains a couple times. What kind of bugs can come up through basement drains?
We don't see a lot of it. I mean, normally drains that are capped and whatnot with water caps underneath have hard things coming out. I will tell you about the only thing that I normally get concerned about are roaches. And roaches, unless you're hooked up to a sewer system or whatnot that's infested, I mean, it's not normal to happen other than in some urban settings we do see roaches, but it usually means the drain trap is went dry. And that's what allowed the critters to come crawling through. Now, on the other hand, once things fall into the basement, things that require high humidity are just going to gravitate to it. So a lot of times it's critters from outside that just end up going to the drain rather than coming up from the drain. This thing have lots of legs?
Lots of legs, kind of flattish. It was very slow. It didn't run when I squashed it.
I bet you it's a house centipede. Which honestly, the normal house centipede we see is not an outdoor critter. It's a critter that can live in walls and the like.
Thanks a lot for calling, Barry. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Insects now with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Every line is filled, so we go right to the phones and Herbert in Clintonville. Hi, Herbert.
Hello. This is, I ran the other day here. I had a big piece of oak limbwood that was about half full of a rotted stuff. It was almost like a consistency of compost. And I was cleaning that out, and I used the limbwood to lay in a garden for chipmunks to hide in. But there was these large white grubs in there. They were almost in like a cocoon that was about almost the size of, a pecan.
Mm-hmm.
And these grubs they looked almost like the white lawn grubs, but they were four or five times bigger.
Yes.
And I scattered them out there around on the bare ground, and I think the birds all took care of them shortly. But I was wondering what that might be.
One of two things, and they're closely related. The grubs of stag beetles and the grubs of something that we call a leather beetle, which is a type of scarab, both do the same thing. They get in that punky, rotten wood. The grubs are big, large, C-shaped, just like the ones you describe. And then you did see the pupil cases or chambers, so they would have transformed. And harmless in the adult stage. And again, once you removed them from that environment, they would not have been able, I think, to complete their development. So nothing to worry about. And again, the association is that you'd never see them in sound wood. They're always in the rotten wood, and some people think they caused the rot, but they came after the rot.
Came after. Thanks, Herbert. Appreciate the call. And Stephen Delafield is up next. Steve, hello.
How are you guys doing?
Good.
Okay. Got a question for you. Long, long time ago, I met a gentleman. He was actually exhibited at a elementary school, and his name was Dan Kapp, and he dealt a lot with butterflies and insects. And I was wondering if you guys knew if he's still around or if he's still had a website or anything?
I don't know if Dan has a website. I know he and his son still do. He still has the big collection. Dan used to deal in insects where he'd sell and trade. I don't think he does that anymore, but I know he does take his collection out. In fact, often when we have the butterfly house here in Madison Oberg Garden, Dan's collection is out there. I know I'd seen him a couple years ago. So he is in the Madison area.
And
if you look under Caps, I think you'd have a good chance of finding his number, and you could give Dan a call. And as I said, usually when I hear about big insect displays at malls and whatnot, one thing, though, is, I mean, Dan travels around the country. I know he's been at entomological meetings and in Indianapolis. I've heard he's been down in Florida. I mean, Dan goes all over showing his collection. He has an amazing collection.
Oh, well, this was in second grade when he had brought his exhibit, and it was by chance that day that I'd brought in a dead hummingbird to show my classmates. He traded me a sunset moss out of Madagascar for it.
Neat.
So I've got a piece of his, and I've always wondered where he was or whatever happened to him.
I actually had him on the show once, a few years back.
One of the things I love about Dan, he's just a real neat person, but Dan got into motorcycles a few years ago, and so he decided he needed a tattoo. He has the largest scarab beetle, or rhinoceros beetle, a male and female. It starts on one shoulder, goes all the way around his back. It's just, which is exactly what I'd expect from Dan. So,
I'll search him out.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, I had him on the show. I forget now. It's been a few years back. He's a Great guy. Fun, interesting guy to
He's
to
also listen. The world record holder for spitting frozen crickets. I saw him on one of those shows the other day. So you never know where Dan's going to pop up.
Richard in Madison, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Sometime back, I heard you speaking about carpet beetles, particularly moths versus carpet beetles. And I have some damage to a wool sweater, and it's in a drawer of many wool sweaters, 8 to 10 of them adjacent, and there are other wool materials. And there's only this single example of damage, and I can find no beetles, no residue, whatever. I wonder what I should do to be sure that I'm free of them.
Well, I mean, ultimately, and I don't think it's worth going this far, if you had everything dry cleaned, that would kill it. But I honestly think, because these critters are big enough to see and easily to dislodge, that one, taking the sweaters out and just vacuuming them lightly so that if anything was there, you'd pull it off.
I've done that.
Then secondly, when you put them away, rather than putting them in a drawer, I would consider getting one of these tight-fitting plastic containers so that you know that nothing can get access. And so that's, I think, a better way to store woolens than putting them in dressers or on closet shelves, just because most of the damage is in the summer when things are left unattended. I can assure you I can find carpet beetles in any person's home. I mean, they feed on such a variety of, you know, hair, feathers, dead insects, whatnot. And so there's always that opportunity. And so, as I said, putting things away clean and then putting them in some kind of good sealing container, I think, is all that really needs to be done. And I'm not a big fan of mothballs. I to be honest, the problem with those things is they work as a fumigant, so you need a closed, tight container to make them work.
Yes.
And again, if things are put away clean in a tight container, you shouldn't have an issue.
And you don't suggest any kind of spray or whatever to get rid of the carpet beetles that may remain?
If you were finding numbers of carpet beetles, then using a standard, really they're using ant and roach sprays, you know, in the baseboards and whatnot, with the idea that if the critters come crawling on them any time in the next 4 or 5 months, it would knock them down. So,
okay, I'm finding none at all.
Yeah, so I think not. I don't see a gaining on using the insecticide. And as I said, it's just unfortunate that you ran into the problem. But I think with a little diligence, you shouldn't have any issues.
Mm-hmm. Before your recent program on the topic, I didn't think we had carpet beetles in this area. We had encountered them in California sometime earlier, but obviously they're here.
Yep.
Well, you know, it's really a whole family of beetles, and there's a large number of species. Many of them are cosmopolitan in distribution just because they've moved around with people. And as I said, they're biologically quite amazing because it's one of the only insect I know that you can deprive them of food as they're growing, and they grow backwards. We call it retrogressive molting, and
okay.
So they're adapted to go through long periods without food and then take advantage when food becomes available.
Okay, thanks very much for your comment.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Someone emailed in, I believe, about controlling silverfish. Are there any clues on controlling silverfish?
Well, they're basically starch and paper feeders. And, you know, one of the things, and I know the company just went out of business, but Miles Kimball used to sell this little sachet that was basically cornstarch mixed with a little boric acid. Now, boric acid works as a stomach poison, and by forcing the silverfish to feed on the cornstarch, it would ingest the boric acid and thereby kill them. And their idea was you throw these back in closets and back in dressers. What I think gets difficult for most people is that, depending on what's going on in your walls, what kind of paper backing you got on your insulation and whatnot, there could always be low numbers of silverfish in the attic or in the walls that I'm not so sure you could magically ever get rid of. My biggest concern is for people that have rare books. Sometimes it's the starch-based binding in books that they're after. Sometimes I've seen them feed on paper directly. I think what's amazing is silverfish do relatively low amounts of damage. They'll also feed on stored clothing. In particular, they seem to be fond of veils and wedding dresses.
Hmm.
And again, I think some of it might have to do with some of the starch and whatnot in context with some of the fabric. And now, if you go the other way, just like almost any of these little indoor critters, residual insecticide sprayed will work. But I think people often go overboard with this. You know, they every week want to go out and spray the kitchen floor. Well, the silverfish aren't living on the kitchen floor. I don't see any reason to spray that. And so if somebody said I had them in the attic, I'd say, well, maybe once a year go and spray a little bit in the corners of the attic would be a way of helping reduce the numbers.
Kim in Clintonville is next. Let's see. Let's go to Kim here. Hi, Kim.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering what I always called snow flea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What exactly are they?
Well, I got a number of calls, even in January, about snow fleas, and it's pretty much a January through March phenomena. They're technically a dark species of springtail. Springtail is a group of insects that are very common in organic matter soil. In fact, I've seen a lot of reports they are the most numerous insect in soil that is rich in organic matter. But there are certain of these dark species that seem to come out when you get little warm-ups or little thaws, and they accumulate on the surface. And the name springtail refers to that they jump, and that's where also the snow flea terminology comes from. They jump like a flea, but they're not a biting creature. If you put them under a microscope, they're wingless. They have three sets of legs like an insect, little pair of antennae. They almost look like little Pillsbury doughboys to me. They're just these little puffy body segments. Now, the interesting thing is what they're doing there. And there are two explanations. One is that this is a population explosion, that there's so many of them in an area, they're just looking for greener pastures, and that's what forces them out. Mm-hmm. The other one is that what we are witnessing is an insect orgy. And I'm not so sure which of the two is the appropriate one. But the phenomenon is you go out there sometimes and see them piled a half an inch deep next to a tree trunk or in an area of a little puddle out in the snow. You come back to the area 2 days later and there's nothing. And that's the typical phenomenon. Other springtails come out during the summer. We just call them springtails. We don't call them snow fleas. So it's kind of reserved to those ones that come out in that early, late winter, early spring period of time.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Kim, for calling. Someone wondered what the outlook is for the mosquito season this year, especially in southern Wisconsin.
Well, I always hesitate to make predictions because, for me, the weather pattern of early May has more to do with insects in general. But the easy thing for me to say about mosquitoes is we have enough water available, enough snow cover. We're going to get more than we've had very little spring flooding recently, but this year we're going to have it. Anytime you have spring flooding, that will cost us in more mosquitoes. Now, the big push will not start until the end of May because we just haven't had enough heat. The other thing, though, we do tell people, we've got mosquitoes that overwinter as adults. So I've already had people tell me they've gotten mosquito bites. Not many. But I think overall, unfortunately, it's going to be what I would call an old-fashioned mosquito year because it has been unusually light for most of the state, and that relates more to this lack of spring flooding and a lot of the dry patterns that we've been getting in the summer lately.
Pauline in Green Bay has a question for you. Hi, Pauline.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
We were infested this winter with box elder bugs. And we can't get rid of them. And they've been here. They're still appearing.
Sure. And again, this was much like we had talked earlier about the Asian lady beetles. Box elder bugs come into structures in the fall. And so everything you've been seeing goes back to what happened last September. And when the walls warm up a little bit, some of them wake up. And then they bother you all winter long. I can assure you they're not breeding. But again, the weakness was when they came in the fall. And now, within the next couple of weeks, they should be waking up and leaving to go back out to the box elder trees. The big question will be what will happen next fall. If it's a wet late summer, they don't do very well. They die naturally. If it's a dry summer, their populations explode. And so that's when I would look at killing them. When they're congregating on the outside of your house, you can kill them with soapy water sprays or a number of the landscape insecticides.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling, Pauline. And on to Ed in Wausau. Hello, Ed.
Hi. Phil, got a problem with mounding black ants. And I eliminated most of them from the backyard by digging down like you recommended a couple of years ago and applying things. But I, in the front yard, I'm still having a problem. I noticed when I was looking at different type of treatments that you can use now, they seem to be really dilute. And I noticed Bayer had a different type of chemical in there. And I was wondering, what would you recommend for, as soon as the snow's gone,
sure,
to get at those things again?
Well, Bayer, I'm guessing they probably had their cyfluthrin spray, which is in about half of their products, and it's very similar to permethrin and the other pyrethroids. you know, the big thing is getting it deep enough. And I don't go to the point of using the shovel as much as I usually just try to get a steel rod or something similar that I can poke two or three holes as deep as I can work it in without, you know, having to cause too much strain. And that's what allows me to channel the insecticide down as much as possible. Now, the newer insecticides tend to be dilute by nature. You know, the old diazinons and whatnot were often put on at about a 1% solution. The newer pyrethroids are just as active at a tenth to a 50th the amount of insecticide. So don't let, just because it's a lower level of active ingredient, and that's the other thing I think to keep in mind when people do things commercially, although they might buy it in a more concentrated form, ultimately they put it on at the same dilution. And so it's not as if they can legally use a higher concentration than you can. They just use a higher concentration when they mix it, but they dilute it down to that same level that you get the ready-to-use products at the local hardware store.
So what you're talking about, instead of using a granulated product, you're talking about using a concentrated liquid.
Oh, yeah. My favorite way to do is to mix it up in a gallon milk container. And to be honest, the old Garden Insecticide 7, or Carbaryl, is an extremely effective ant material. And so I'm not even so sure you got to get anything new in newfangled products, that old insecticide. And so this case, getting some liquid 7, mixing it up and drenching it in. And as I said, that's what that metal bar helps me to channel it deep. And what we're trying to do there is kill the queen, which is down in the ground. And that's the secret to success. If you kill the queen, the colony's dead.
Okay, thanks for the program.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Mark in McFarland, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. Happy April Fool's Day to both of you. Bill, I'm calling to ask about a big black fly that has come into the bathroom, and I suspect that the only path of entrance is through the bathroom exhaust fan. There have been three of them, and it's only been in one particular bathroom. And I'm kind of curious about their life cycle, and curious if possibly the scents of the scented soap and whatnot are what's attracting it to come in.
Well, I'm real suspicious you have either a blowfly or a flesh fly, which tells me that you've got something dead either on the roof or in the attic. The phenomena, usually it's like, you know, no flies and then lots of flies. So you honestly haven't seen many yet compared to what we often get.
I've seen is three in the period of a year.
Okay. Well, then it could just be blowflies coming in by accident, and I'm not sure what's attracting them. I mean, they just kind of randomly go through anyway, but it definitely wouldn't be the scented soaps. They tend to like to get in things that are off-smelling and flavored. That's why we call them carrion flies to some degree, because that's what they're attracted to is animals that tend to bloat and have some real offensive odors to them.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Gene in Mequonago, your turn. Hi, Gene.
Hi. I'm glad to talk to you and glad to get all this information. Last summer we had a moth that was about 3 inches from head to tail and probably a wingspan of 4 to 5 inches, mottled gray, and I was wondering if it's something to be feared, going to chew out my trees, or if it's just
thing. It's more of, I think, a treasure. It's a wild silkworm, and the color of yours sounds like it's a Cecropia moth. I just put up on my website, you know, every winter gives me an opportunity to get some things up, and I put a PDF on Wisconsin's wild silkworms, and that's what this is a wild silkworm. Yeah. And we've got five species of very big, attractive moths, and so I've got pictures of both the caterpillars and whatnot on my website. But Cecropia is a very short-lived as an adult, a couple, 3 days at best before the bats tend to eat them. Their caterpillars feed on a variety of trees, couple shrubs, but it's minor damage. I mean, their numbers just don't get high enough to cause any significant kind of problems. And so to me, again, they're more of kind of a curiosity and definitely nothing to worry about. And again, they're just kind of fun to have around. And I mean, most people don't realize that we have such large insects. You think you normally have to go to the jungles to find them. Well, we
right.
do have a handful that you see
right.
here.
Well, it was gorgeous, but I didn't know if I should be concerned. So it's a lot.
Yeah. Thanks for coming. By the way, what's your website?
Probably the easiest way is to go to the entomology department, which is entomology, E-N-T-O-M-O-L-O-G-Y, .wisc.edu, and that will be our department homepage. And if you just go under outreach, and then the diagnostic lab, you'll get my lab directly. That may be the easiest way. The other way is to do the entomology.wisc.edu/ENTODIAG, which stands for Entomology Diagnostic Lab. And we updated the insect ID section. Again, I added some things under the extension bulletin section and the like, and we had a couple broken links there that hopefully we've fixed. So,
all right. On to Dave in Green Bay. Dave, hello to you.
Good afternoon. I have a problem with drugstore beetles. I went to my local extension, county extension office, and had them tell me what they were.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that I have to remove the food source to get them out of the house. I seem to get a lot more in the warm weather when it's... This last winter, I've hardly seen any at all, but I do see one every now and again. And without ripping apart my whole kitchen, I can't seem to find the source and get rid of them. Is there anything I can do?
Well, it gets frustrating because, to be honest, this is a case where spraying, I think, wouldn't get you. It's kind of like shooting in the dark. It really won't get it. One of the things to keep in mind about drugstore beetles is they're fond of spices, potpourri, a lot of things that are not normally considered food stuff, and that's where the name comes from, is that they would attack old pharmaceuticals that were the leaves and stems of things. I've seen them in pet food. I see them in old mouse bait. So I worry about a bag of dog food somewhere from 3 years ago you forgot about in the basement as being the whole source. And what makes them somewhat unique in the insects attacking food is that they fly. Most of the insects don't. And they're attracted to light. So I expect them to show up at windows.
That's exactly where they show up, on my big window.
Yeah. Okay. So again, I would look into spices, pepper, tea, cigars, anything that is dry plant material. So it's a broader food range than you normally expect of thinking about cereals and flour and that kind of thing. And when you find the packaging, it will look like you hit it with a shotgun because they leave very round BB-sized holes when the adults emerge. And they're really a type of wood-boring beetle. That's the family they come from, and they have very similar holes that you see in dead trees and firewood.
Interesting. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Deb in Milwaukee? Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have so many questions, but the one special question I have is I was bit by a spider about 5 years ago. I moved into a house that hadn't been lived in for a long time, and I got really sick, and I couldn't figure it out. And then I wouldn't go back in the house for like 6 months. And then when I did, my son and I were sleeping in the same room, and we would slept in two like twin beds. And I didn't know it, but the clean out for the shower, which is the next room, was right behind one bed. But he started getting bites on his arm. And one day I was vacuuming, and I hit the bed. I left the room, and I hit the bottom of the bed with the vacuum. I came back in, and there's this big brown spider. I mean, it was it had a white star on its back. And I just stood there in shock for a while. I'm like, oh, that's what was on me and bit me?
Running out of time here, I'll let Phil get in.
Normally, when people get multiple bites, we don't expect it to be spiders. That's not the way they work. When spiders typically bite, you can get a lot of localized tissue damage, almost like a little ulceration eventually, but nothing systemic. We don't have any kind of venoms that go through the body other than with a black widow. So I'm not quite sure there. And the other thing is, I will tell you, generally the bigger and scarier the spiders look, the less likely they are to be the culprits. It's some of the smaller spiders that we seem to have more reactions to.
All right. And thank you very much, Deb. Appreciate the call. You're going to have to call back again next time Phil's on and get those other questions answered. Appreciate it very much. Phil, we'll look forward to your next visit, probably a month or so.
Sounds good.
Sounds good to me, too. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. He'll be back in about a month, and we'll talk with him some more about insects. I mentioned I was going to be speaking tomorrow night with Steve Paulson, something called Wednesday Night at the Lab on the UW-Madison campus from 7 to 8:30 or so. It's at the Genetics Biotech Center. And just go online to Wednesday Night at the Lab, and you'll find all the information you need. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.